y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s-loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of terrorism, bombing, anti-LGBTQ violence, and anti-abortion violence. Listener discretion is advised.
In 1996, the Summer Olympics were held in Atlanta, Georgia. On July 27th, thousands had gathered at Centennial Park for a late-night concert. The FBI was told that a tip was called into 911 saying that a bomb would go off in the park within 30 minutes. A search ensued, and the bomb was located by security guard Richard Jewell. An evacuation was ordered, but 3 minutes into it, the bomb detonated. Two people died as a result of the bombing, and 111 others were injured. The person responsible wouldn't be captured until 2003, but before that, Richard Jewell was cast as the hero, then, unjustly, the villain in the bombing.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear it from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
Bad day to do a right thing.
Right? I mean, also, I just learned so much with this episode. Marky Mark, sorry, Mark, you don't like that. Mark wrote this episode, and a big thanks to him, but he also requested it. So, hey, girl, thanks again. But he's going to teach us like a bunch of stuff about the Olympics that I did not know.
Yeah, let's learn about the Olympics.
Let's do it. So the event that serves as the catalyst for today's episode occurred at a world event that takes place every 4 years. The Summer Olympics.
The Olympics.
Yeah, I was like, that's not the, okay, I remember. Yeah. That's a little Phoebe quote there. So we're going to start out by taking a look at the Olympic Games and what hosting the Games can do for a city or country. When I tell you I had no idea that this, it was just like, oh, okay, we announced it, you know, like
Like my husband's company every year for their annual convention, it's like, next year we'll do it in Orlando. This year we'll do it in this room. Who cares? You know, whatever. We'll just pick a hotel and go. Like, I had no idea. So we all know what the Olympics are, but what many might not know is the effect that hosting the games can have on the area. So the host cities are decided years in advance as an example. So right now, the Summer Games of 2028 are set to take place in Los Angeles, and the 2030 Winter Games host city will be announced next summer, 2024. And one might think, do you really need that much time to prepare for it?
Oh, yes you do.
Yes. There's generally about a 6 to 7 year gap in the time that a city is selected to host and when the games take place. And that's to give the city enough lead time to make good on their sales pitch.
I do what?
What sales pitch, do you ask? Let us learn. Cities don't just get awarded the games based on their name or popularity. That statement could be a little misleading because the games are never going to get awarded to a little old town like Bellbuckle, Tennessee. Or any city that would not be able to handle the influx of people that would come. So, teeny tiny little towns, no bigger than your mama's Jack Russell, never going to have the Olympics there. It's just not going to happen. But in order to be considered for hosting duties, each city has to give a sales pitch. Really wanted to say pinch. A sales pitch, essentially. They go up and they go, here.
Ow! I didn't want a sales pinch.
Oh, you said sales pitch. I'm so sorry. Yes. I thought you said sales pinch. My bad. And we're not just talking about like a quick PowerPoint presentation that like you like run through. Maybe you design on Canva. Lots Ooh. Of templates on there.
That's the way to go if you're going to do it.
Canva is where you want to be.
For your presentation.
Exactly. But this is not something you would quickly like throw together like, oh, okay, here, pick our city for this or whatever. Cities invest millions of dollars just on gathering information, preparing a bid, and then submitting it to the International Olympic Committee or the IOC.
Oh, if you're nasty.
Yeah, because I've heard of that now. I know what it is. Now, the amounts that a city has to put up for these bids can vary from year to year, depending on the size of the cities, the facilities they already have to accommodate the games, etc. But just as an example, in a bid for the 2016 games, Tokyo is estimated to have spent as much as, y'all, get ready, $150 million. And that was for a failed bid. They did not even get selected.
The IOC is like, better luck next year, Tokyo.
Yeah, exactly. Like, $150 million. And they were like, no, that's going to be a no. And then for the 2020 games, they spent around half that amount and they ended up being selected as the host city. So that's kicking the pants.
Salt in the wound. Yeah, that ain't good.
Yeah. And you might think, okay, well, that's a lot of money to spend, but look at all the people it brings into the city and the tourism boom that comes from it and all of those things. But that amount is only to try to get selected to host. Okay? So you've been selected.
Now you have to spend a whole buttload more money just
now
to
you have
get
to
it ready.
The money, yeah, to meet the requirements. So the IOC has all these requirements in place. One of them is that the host cities have at minimum 40,000 hotel rooms available. So for the 2016 games in Rio, they had to construct 15,000 hotel rooms to meet that requirement.
Jeez.
Like, okay. Facilities that are currently in place might need to be upgraded. They might have to build new infrastructure, you know, roads, train lines, airports, etc. You had to build an airport just for the Olympics.
That's outrageous.
Like, that all adds up. So the cost of construction for new facilities or upgrades to current ones can vary and range from measly $5 billion to $50 billion.
That makes my stomach
hurt. Now, cities and countries justify these costs in a few different ways. One is the immediate economic benefits that come. There are tons of people who come from all over the world to root on their countrymen and women. While at the games, these people spend money invigorating the local economy. And the upgrades or newly built areas can leave a lasting legacy. They can improve the overall infrastructure of the city, which then in turn can make it more attractive for future residents or businesses. It can definitely have very positive outcomes. Jobs are created from the day a city is awarded the games. Various industries see a boom in employment, from construction to hospitality and security and event management. And then these new jobs in turn boost the local economy further. It also opens up future opportunities for the city. So let's say that a city doesn't have an updated stadium and a state-of-the-art stadium is built for the Olympics. Well, after the games, they can now use that state-of-the-art stadium to lure in a sports team to relocate maybe, or it might put you in the running to get a stop on the Taylor Swift tour.
Ooh la la.
I think that would be the most important reason to build a stadium, but that's just me.
Reason enough for me.
Exactly. I am now working on a stadium. While there are many positives, there are also some negatives associated with hosting the games, the least of which is the displacement of local residents. Sometimes the new construction can cause social disruptions for communities. I don't know about you, but anytime there's road work here, they're like, this should take us 6 months. And it's like 9 years later, you're like, y'all still are not done with that?
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand it. In some cases, people have been forced to relocate without proper compensation or alternative housing available. Because, like, if we need your house for where the stadium's going to be, well, that's your too bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sounds like a you problem.
Exactly. I mean, you could find another house here, but now the houses have doubled or tripled in cost because now we're a pretty hopping place. So,
mm-hmm. Also a you problem. So, sorry. There are also security concerns that may impact the daily lives of residents, and the costs associated with maintaining proper security at these events can be absolutely astronomical. Another big thing that can be impacted is the trust that the locals have with their government. If something happens, it paints the town in a negative light, or if the promised benefits that come with hosting the games don't materialize, it can lead to social and political tension amongst residents.
A lot of stuff involved.
I just feel like that's a whole thing. That's like a whole thing.
I would call it a whole thing. Yeah.
And I also know that, like, in Nashville, the NFL draft came to Nashville however many years ago now. And the news was doing a bunch of reports about how anytime a big event like that, specifically if it's, or more so with an event that is male dominated, like the NFL draft, it's going to be a lot of men coming into the city because they want to attend the draft or whatever. Sex trafficking goes up like through the roof. And so they were putting together like safety things, one of which being like, if your kid's on Snapchat, turn the location off. This news article said that in Snapchat, your location is automatically on. You have to choose for it to be off, not the other way around. But that you can, you know, when people post, it like has their location or whatever, I guess. I don't know. I don't do Snapchat. Couldn't figure it out. Can't find anyone's page. I didn't like it. So you could see like where a kid is down to like the intersection that they're at.
It's terrifying.
That's really scary stuff. So I don't know. Anyway, there's just a lot of stuff, you know, that comes with a huge influx of people at one time. In 1996, the Summer Olympics were held in the city that has the busiest international airport in the U.S., the city that Coca-Cola calls home, and that's Atlanta, Georgia. The estimated cost of the 1996 Olympics was around $1.7 billion. Over 10,000 athletes competed across 26 sports. The U.S. topped the medal table with 101 total. This included winning the most gold medals, 44, and silver medals, 32. While the Olympic Games are generally a time that the world comes together and celebrates the athletes representing them, the 1996 Games were marred by a tragic event.
On July.
My goodness, you had two words in, girl. Starting out rough.
Stop it. On July 27th, 1996, thousands had gathered in Centennial Park for a late-night concert featuring Jack Mack and the Heart Attack.
That's a rhyming name.
I like it. And Mark graciously did a little digging on this band. I've never heard of them before. He had heard of them, couldn't name a song of theirs, but apparently they've had 10 albums released from 1980 to 2019. One of their most popular songs appears to be a cover of Otis Redding's I've Been Loving You Too Long. They have a lot of people that have come and gone in the band. There are 9 members currently of the band, but they had like more than 30 members previously. And the actual bomb didn't detonate until around 1:20 a.m. And as someone who has been a longtime Golden Girl, being out and about at 1:20 a.m., not my ministry personally. Wouldn't be there?
No.
Because I struggled to stay up after, let's say, I used to say 10. Now I'm going to go with 9.
100%.
But if you are out at that hour of the night and you're seeing Jack Mack and the Heart Attack, you should be able to without having to worry about somebody setting off a bomb. There were several security personnel on site during the concert, including the FBI. One agent, David Johnson, received a notice that 911 received a call about a bomb being placed at the venue. And we would later learn that the call was placed 18 minutes before the actual detonation. Now, the caller was described as a, quote, white male with an indistinguishable American accent. The caller told the operator that a bomb would go off within 30 minutes somewhere in the park. It was later determined that that call came from a payphone near the park. Now, we're going to talk about Richard Jewell. Jewell was working security near the sound and light tower for the concert. He was born in Virginia, but he moved to Georgia with his mom when he was 6 years old. He graduated from Towers High School and worked at a law office after high school. One lawyer he befriended while working there described him as very earnest, sometimes to the point of being annoying. So basically, when he believed in something or believed he was right, he would not back down. Jewell always wanted to be a police officer. In 1990, he landed an entry-level job as a jailer with the Habersham County Sheriff's Department while also working a second job as a security guard for the apartment complex that he lived in. And while he was working this job, Jewell was arrested for impersonating an officer. So is he seems a little do as I say, not as I do. Or kind of like, remember in school when somebody was like, you're going to be hall monitor, and you take that job a little too seriously?
Yeah, and I think too, he just really wanted to be a police officer.
But you can't just be like, okay, now I'm a police officer.
Right. Although I was like, I thought if you worked in the jail that you were a police officer. Like, I guess corrections and police officers are different.
Yes.
And I just didn't realize that until like a couple years ago. I would have thought it was a police officer.
If anybody's in a uniform, I pretty much think that they are a police officer. Yeah. It doesn't really matter. But,
exactly.
But I mean, it's just kind of interesting that he's very like straight laced, like straight as an arrow, follow the rules. If you see something done wrong, he can't stand for it. But then he gets in trouble. He gets arrested for impersonating an officer.
Yeah.
He pled guilty to disorderly conduct and was put on probation. He worked as a deputy sheriff for 5 years and was remembered for his zeal for the job and his tendency to wreck patrol cars. Hell of a thing to be remembered as, or for. After his fourth crash, Jewell was demoted back to a jailer, but he chose to resign instead. He was hired as a campus cop in 1995 at Piedmont College. He was not a great fit at the college, though. Jewell would write long, detailed reports on minor incidents. He upset college officials when he stopped someone for operating with one taillight. So the main highway ran past the school. But the thing is, traffic violations were supposed to be handled by the Demorest Police Department, not campus security. So it wasn't his job to do that. He also got into trouble when he made a DUI arrest on the highway and didn't follow protocol by radioing the police department to handle the case. He really wanted to do it himself.
Yeah, I think it really was one of those things where he's like, I think he genuinely thought he was helping.
Yeah.
Like, I can do this. I know how to do it. I've done it before. I can just handle it.
He wanted to be really helpful,
like, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. But obviously, like, you can't. That's not how you do it.
He resigned in May of 1996 and moved from his apartment to his mother's apartment. And she was about to have foot surgery. And he wanted to be there for her and also find a police job in the Atlanta area after the games.
In June, he began working for a security firm contracted by AT&T, which was building a stage in Centennial Park, and they were the sponsor of the concert. Jewel joked to a friend that if anything happened at the games, he wanted to be in the middle of it. And he was. Good. He's very intuitive. He's like an oracle. Jewel was around the sound tower where there were also some benches scattered around. And around midnight, the band took a break and a group of 7 college-age guys went to the benches and sat down. They were drunk and they had been drinking for a while. 5 of them sat on one bench and 2 on another. They were very loud, which drew Jewel's attention. So he watched them closely and he noticed that they had 2 large bags. One was a cooler that he saw them take cans of beer out of, and the other seemed to be a big army-style backpack, which they had shoved under the bench. So he goes over, he tells them to calm down, stop throwing beer cans into the sound tower, lock it up.
I tell you this.
Exactly. Yeah. So then he gets the attention of Tom Davis, a Georgia Bureau of Investigations agent working security at the park. And he asked Tom to talk to the men because they just wouldn't listen to him. He thought that hearing from someone who was actually in law enforcement would make them stop. They walked to the tower, but most of the men had already left, and a couple were picking up cans from around the tower. Jewel looked at the benches and noticed that the army bag was still there and said one of them must have left it. Davis yelled to them, asking if they forgot a bag, and they said it wasn't theirs. There were a few hundred people sitting in a grassy knoll in front of the tower, and Davis and Jewel quickly went to people close, asking if the bag belonged to any of them, but nobody claimed it. Davis declared it as a suspicious package and called the bomb squad. They cleared a 15-foot radius to give the bomb squad room to investigate, and this is at 12:57 a.m. About a minute later, the 911 call was placed, so they found the bag right around the same time as that 911 call. Jewel had radioed his direct supervisor when they found the bag, and after the bomb squad was called, he went into the sound tower. He goes to each floor and tells everyone, quote, "We've got a situation in front of the tower. Law enforcement is on the scene and they are checking it. I don't know what it is right now, but it is a suspicious package. If I come back in here and tell you to get out, there will be no questions. There will be no hesitation. Drop what you are doing and get the fuck out." So, I mean, his heart's in the right place, obviously, and he's doing a great job right now.
Mm-hmm.
Jewel said that as he came back down the tower, he counted everyone in there, so he knew exactly how many people were there, and there were 11. By the time he left the tower, the bomb squad was on the scene. As you would expect, they were being extremely careful. They were trying to check the bag from every angle. One man laid on the ground with a small flashlight and shined it inside, and he just froze. He very, very slowly crawled back out from under the bench, and he said the size, or he was asked the size, and he said, quote, "big, real big." When asked if they should evacuate, he nodded his head. All the officers began to evacuate people as quickly as possible while avoiding causing a panic. The last thing they wanted was the crowd running all, you know, just pandemonium. Everybody freaking out, trampling each other, that kind of thing. So Jewel goes to the tower and starts going floor by floor telling everyone to GTFO. As people tried to pack things up to take with them, he grabbed them and shoved them down the steps, trying to make them understand that this is serious. You have to go now. Jewel went floor by floor. He confirmed that each one was empty. And when he walked out of the tower, a trooper asked him if it was clear, and he said yes. Around the benches where the bomb was, there were still people just meandering around, sitting in the grass or on the benches, refusing to leave. The officers that were on the scene formed a line of sorts between the bomb and these people. About a minute after Jewel left the tower, he said all he heard was a big boom. It knocked him forward and he fell on his hands and knees. He quickly regained his bearings. He looks around. The line of officers that had formed had been blown through the air. He rushed to the nearest one and tried to help him, and he told him to just lay flat and they were going to get him help. Tom Davis described it as utter chaos. There were troopers and agents down. There were screaming coming from all over. Alice Hawthorne was 44 years old when she drove from Albany, Georgia, to join the Olympic festivities. Excuse me. She was killed by shrapnel from the explosion. She was hit 6 times. One wound to her head proved to be fatal. Mili Uzunyal was a cameraman for a Turkish news organization. He was 40 years old and had survived the wars of Azerbaijan, Bosnia, and the Persian Gulf. After the explosion, he was rushing to the scene when he had a heart attack and passed away. There were 111 other injuries, but no other fatalities. The city and country were in shock after the bombing, and an investigation into who was responsible kicked into gear immediately.
So officials held a press conference later in the morning after the explosion. During that press conference, they credited a security guard with finding the bomb, enabling evacuation procedures to start, and a large number of people being removed from harm's way. Later that afternoon, Richard Jewell gave his first interview. He said he was really nervous. He'd never done an interview or anything like that before. And the interviewer was like, just relax, just tell us what happened. You know, that's all you have to do. He also did warn Richard that he would be inundated with interview requests, like, just get ready for that. And he's like, why don't you just like kind of think about how many you want to do? You know, you can kind of get prepared and all that kind of stuff. So the first interview was not very in-depth. After that, Jewell talked with FBI about what happened. He sat down again for a more in-depth interview. Then the calls came in from all over the country. USA Today, the Boston Globe, everyone wanted to talk to the hero. And Richard Jewell is finally getting what he wants, right? He has wanted to be in law enforcement. He's wanted to help. He's wanted to do something good.
Noble. And yeah.
Yeah. And he did. Like, the FBI and anybody who was like doing interviews were saying, like, he did exactly what he was supposed to do. He saw a bag that was suspicious. He called it in. He evacuated the area. He made sure that, like they said, without him doing that, definitely many more people would have been hurt. And there could have been, likely would have been more fatalities. Yeah. Like,
he saved no counting. I mean, who knows how many people?
Yeah. And like, that's, everybody was just like, dude, like, exactly the way that protocol was supposed to go, you nailed it. Mm-hmm. Like, excellent. But then all that came to an end, basically. Everybody was like, he's a hero, he's a hero, he's a hero. And then, so after seeing his interview on TV, Ray Clear, the president of Piedmont College, where Jewell had worked, called the FBI, and he expressed concern that Richard Jewell might have been involved with the bombing, telling them that he had information about, quote, improper conduct by Jewell while he worked at the school. And he's referring to Jewell pulling cars over when he wasn't supposed to. Now, please tell me, if Richard Jewell had been planting drugs in cars to find the drugs, or planting drugs on people, or just causing something so that he could
become the hero in that situation,
then I could see how the two are related.
Well, sure. Like, I've heard of, and we'll talk a little bit about it, but like, you know, firefighters that start fires just to be able to put them out and be like, see what I did, or nurses cause cardiac arrest and then go in and save them and just in the nick of time. And
right. Or kids who save squirrels.
First, I knocked them out of their nest with a rock.
Yeah, like that's from
while you were sleeping,
by the way. But yeah, like that, I don't see how the two, like, he's pulling people over. No, he's not supposed to.
What does this have to do with anything?
How is that the same? Right. How does that then in your brain go, well, he might have had something to do with this bombing?
Right. He cheated on his ninth grade geometry test, probably planted that bomb.
Exactly. Clear would later say that the call was only placed so the FBI would know that the school was going to cooperate fully with this investigation, because they assumed, well, since Richard Jewell was close to the bombing, they were going to investigate everybody, right? So if they investigated him, which they were going to, the school would have come up. And so he was just calling to be like, hey, I know him. I know you're going to call me. I'm fully willing to cooperate. He may have bombed this thing, though. So check that out.
So here's my thoughts, and I could be completely wrong. I'm not, you know, I don't know all of the things all of the time. I think in that situation, if that was legit and you really were just, your intention was to be like, look, I will cooperate fully, completely. Wait for the call. Wait for the call to you. Because what you have done, whether you meant to or not, is caused, you set this ball in motion.
He wasn't on anybody's radar, apparently, until you were like, I think Richard did it.
Well, right, because if you're saying the reason for the call is just so they know you're going to cooperate, then if you had to make a call to tell them you were going to cooperate, you could have called and said, hey, if you have to talk to us, we're going to cooperate.
Right. There are so many ways that you could spin that and work that to where it just makes, to where mm-hmm. your explanation of why you did it would actually be believable because.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can't, I know we can't blame one person for all of this. It was one of those situations where like this guy made this call. The FBI was under a ton of pressure, and so maybe they were not doing all of their due diligence. The media wanted to be first because we got, you know, it's like all of these things, but like, come on, you know? And after the bombing happened, there were no like radical groups taking credit for the bombing. No eyewitnesses saw the bomb being placed. Like, they didn't really have anything to go on. The only thing they had was there was some like people that were there. This is 1996, had camcorders. Some people did. And so there was at one point this like one somebody walks by the media and the police dubbed this blob man. That's how clear the picture was. It was just a blob. And they brought NASA in to try to like, you know, enhance the visual and stuff like that. But like, essentially, they had absolutely nothing to go on. There were twice daily calls between the Washington and Atlanta FBI, and Richard Jewell's name first arose during a call on Sunday, 5 p.m. So that's the day after the bombing. And there were other factors that drew the FBI towards Jewell as well. One was from a series of fires that had been set in Southern California. And it turned out, like you said, that the fires were actually being set by a volunteer firefighter. Okay. This is what the FBI says. Well, there's other things that made us think that it could be him. None of them have anything to do with him. They all have things to do with, like, one time I heard a guy did this. What if that's what's happening here? Should you investigate every single person there? Yes, you should. But the factors that they're talking about that led them to Jewell as well were the one guy calling and saying he did something he wasn't supposed to do when he worked for me, so maybe he did the bombing. And then all of these other situations where like this firefighter would, you know, start the fires, he'd put the fires out, he was named a hero for it. In 1984, the games were held in LA, and a security guard working there had planted a fake bomb on a bus with a plan to discover it later, becoming the hero. So the FBI started to investigate Richard Jewell. They talked with people who knew him. They looked into his work history. One man told them that he thought Jewell would be capable of placing a bomb if he thought no one would get hurt. That's not evidence.
No, it's not. And also, I feel like this is so... Do you remember that show that we covered, Trial by Media? This is absolutely yes. That. But it's because it's so salacious. Like, who doesn't... The sad thing about our society, and I won't... I'm not going to be like, everybody else sucks, and I don't do that. I mean, I'm sure people love to see someone fall from grace. People yes. live for it.
Mm-hmm.
So what better yeah. story than the hero becoming the villain immediately? It right. sells.
Mm-hmm. It does. And again...
And it gets people off of the law enforcement's back, right? Like, I didn't mean to cut you off, but like, you know.
Exactly. They're under a lot of pressure. This is a high priority or high profile case. It's the freaking Olympic Games.
The freaking Olympic Games.
The freaking games. And like, the media is like, who the frick did it? We don't even know. And, but they're not using any evidence. They're just like, well, this guy said he thinks he probably could have done it.
And I feel like, hear me out here. I mean, Richard Jewell seems to have been a very, very sweet guy. Very sweet guy. But I think that he kind of, to me too, whenever, because I'm intrigued to see the movie, Richard Jewell. But I... did watch the show. I cannot think of what it's called now for anything. I really did enjoy that show.
The Crimes That Changed Us?
I think it's The Crimes That Changed Us. Yes, absolutely. But I watched that, and seeing him, while I think that he was amazing, he seems to have been kind of somewhat of an easy target. Like,
yeah,
he's very vulnerable. He's slightly naive. He, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. Yeah. Like, yeah. He reminded me a touch of like Stephen Avery, where it's like, well, we can do this to him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. This man who thought that he could have maybe placed the bomb also said that Jewel had been blackballed from joining local law enforcement because of his history as a sheriff's deputy. And the FBI also saw where he'd been arrested for impersonating an officer. And for them, all of these things fell into place just perfectly.
You can't.
I still have not heard one thing that falls into place.
No. You can't get in trouble for anything anymore. You know what I mean? Like, they're really drawing, they're drawing mm-hmm. connections that it's a reach. There's nothing. Like you said, there's nothing.
Yeah. If he'd previously been arrested for making bombs.
Right.
Okay, now we're sizzling with fajita meat. But that's not what this is. He impersonated as an officer.
And while I do think that's bad,
that's not making bombs.
No, it's not.
I mean, come on.
Hey, you guys, have you ever wondered about the backstory, like why we call our dad Miss KB? We have gotten this question so many times, we thought we'd release a little freebie for you.
So we recorded a Patreon-exclusive Q&A last year, and be warned, we were outside and there was some wind, mm-hmm. where we answered this question, and we want y'all to have the answer even if you're not a patron.
Yeah, so be sure to head to killerqueens.link/MissKB, M-I-S-S-K-B, and grab the audio.
And don't forget, if you want the full Q&A or access to our entire catalog of over 450 patron-only episodes with all our regular episodes ad-free, you can join the Patreon for less than 1.5 Starbucks drinks per month.
I mean, that's a good deal.
It's a steal.
It is. It's a steal. You'll get 4 episodes per week from us, all ad-free, plus anything fun we do like Q&As or literally anything else. So definitely check it out.
And not every tier includes every episode.
Yeah, we do have different tiers. So just be sure everything's listed out there when you check it out. But in the meantime, be sure to grab your free audio about Miss KB and how he came to be called that at killerqueens.link/MissKB.
Behavioral specialists at Quantico had watched the interviews Jewel gave and said that he, quote, fit the profile of a person who might create an incident so he could emerge as a hero.
Again, he looks like somebody who could have done it. What does that person look like?
Right.
Because you and I look like him too. I'm mm-hmm. guarantee it.
Well, and if you're just talking about somebody who is glad to receive the attention of something nice that they've done, like that you performed a heroic act and then people are calling you a hero and you're like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. Like,
that's what I was going to say. Like, who doesn't want a pat on the back for you, doing something good?
Right. And he put himself in harm's way. I mean, he stayed around that area. It could have detonated anytime. He could have GTFO'd and been like, y'all are on your own. Like, he didn't do that. He went up this tower, gets all the people out, is talking like, hey, we've got to get you guys out of here. And they're just like, wow, well, that's exactly what somebody who planted the bomb would do.
And also, I feel like who knows? We brought it up, so they probably knew about it too. But that friend that was like, you know, he said he wanted to be in all the action and everything. They probably use that against him too. But he never once did he say, I really want to do something heroic and be known for it across the world. He didn't say that. He just right. wanted to be where the action was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, I mean, you always, I remember, you know, in high school, like we were getting ready to graduate and there would be boys who are like, you know, I'm joining the military because this was fairly soon after 9/11. And they're like, I want to go to war. I want to go to war. It's like that kind of thing. Like,
I want to do something noble and heroic. And
yeah. And yeah. I want to serve. And I want to, yeah. Monday afternoon, Kathy Scruggs, a reporter who covered the Atlanta Police Department, heard rumors from a source that the FBI was investigating Richard Jewel. And the source said, look, you can't do anything with this information because it could impede the investigation. And she said, I understand that. But if I can corroborate this information from an independent source, I'm printing it.
Can you just do that?
That shit should be illegal.
I know. Like, can you just do that?
Yeah. And like, how many cases have we covered where we're like, the media dropped something before it should have been dropped, and then this person ran away, or they killed another person, or the, you know, like,
I mean, it is like, no. It has fucked up so many investigations because they ran something that they shouldn't have run.
And just to be first, like, that's all there is to it. Meanwhile, the FBI is making plans to interview Jewel. A non-confrontational interview is what they called it. And that was supposed to take place Tuesday afternoon. They had already had someone talk with Jewel while wearing an audio recorder. And then depending on how the first interview went, they were going to have a confrontational interview and possible polygraph Wednesday morning. Before they could, though, things changed. So Kathy Scruggs received a page from the Atlanta police. And when she called them, they told her the authorities were looking into Jewel. She asked how they knew, and they told her everybody's talking about it at the station. Like, it is a thing that everybody knows. Kathy told her employers they needed to run the story. If everyone at the police station knew, it's going to be common knowledge really soon. So they ran the story, which went out in their daily extra edition on Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. Minutes later, a news anchor on CNN held the paper up on TV, showing the headline, FBI suspects hero guard may have planted bomb. The anchor then read the entire article on air word for word.
And once that's out there, no matter how many, and I don't even know if they did, but how many retractions, how many anything you run, nobody is going to believe it.
You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. It's out. It's done.
Now you've ruined someone's, you've ruined lives.
Yeah, exactly. And so Richard Jewell and his mom are watching the Olympic Games that night because they were conflicted about, do we keep it going? Do we stop it? Whatever. And they were like, the games must go on. And so they did kept them going or whatever. So they're watching it. And then here comes Tom Brokaw on the news and is like, hey, there's enough evidence that authorities have to arrest and prosecute Richard Jewell. They've still got to do a little bit more, but that's what's happening. And they're at home like,
yeah.
What? Because like when he was going to be interviewed again by the FBI, the media is all up his ass or whatever. And he's like, no, I'm not a suspect. Like I'm driving there in my own car. They're just getting information. Like I'm going to work right after this. They haven't asked me to not leave the country. Like I'm not a suspect. They're not calling me a suspect. Like he really didn't think that anything was going on. Like you said, you know, he had kind of that touch of like being naive, which I think a lot of us in that situation do like
absolutely.
How could they suspect me? I have nothing to do with it, you know, like I didn't do anything wrong.
I just felt bad for him looking like seeing the entire case play out, because to me I was like, Angel, like poor, you know, I just felt so bad for him because I'm like, oh, he just doesn't know. I have the benefit of, you know, hindsight, or like I'm outside of it and I've heard the whole story and I know what's going to happen, but I'm like, oh buddy, like
I know.
He trusted him.
Yeah, he trusted him. And his mom said that when they searched that apartment, she was like, they dumped the flour out of the containers. They dumped the sugar out of the containers. Like they left a huge mess. They made like a big spectacle of this search.
That is something that I learned in the TV show Heist that we covered.
Yep.
Where I was like, wow, they don't put that shit back.
No. And they break stuff. They throw stuff on the ground. Like they don't care. Yeah. And then you've got to come clean it up. Like it's insane. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, they didn't find anything. But
didn't stop him, though.
Nope, didn't stop him. So he ended up being named as a person of interest, but he was never arrested. You know, they did the searches. His background was exhaustingly investigated, and he became the subject of some of the most intense media scrutiny we have ever seen.
It's so like that cautionary tale, like, be careful what you wish for. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
He's like, I literally was just trying to help.
Yeah. Like you can be a hero for a day,
mm-hmm.
but then the entire world's going to turn against you.
Exactly. On October 6th, the FBI interviewed Jewel for 6 hours. And at the conclusion told them, nah, we don't think you had anything to do with it.
How about I mess up your life for the rest of your entire life, ruin the best moment that you've ever had, and just be like, whoops.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to talk about like tainting a memory? That would have been, and may still have been, the thing that he is most proud of that he's done, did in his entire life. Like that,
and that's enough
courage
to be proud of. Yes.
Yeah. That's incredible. And then all of this, they're like, yeah, but what if he did it? Wouldn't it be good if he did it? Wouldn't it sell magazines and sell newspapers if he's the one that did it? That would be great. So let's perpetuate that. There are still people who think that like they hear the name Richard Jewell because the guy who actually did it, I didn't know his name.
I've never even heard of him.
Yeah, but I knew Richard Jewell's name. I had heard of him. So there are still plenty of people who, when they hear his name, they're like, oh, that's the Atlanta bombing guy. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, no, but you cannot put it back. Mm-mm. Once you take it out. I mean, come on.
And there's nothing you can do about it either. You can't sue anybody for defamation of character or for slander, like, because there's no intent of harmful, you know, like wrongdoing or malicious intent or whatever like that. It's like,
they're just like, oh, well, we got it wrong. I mean, we can't get them all right.
Yeah.
Sorry. 20 days later, the U.S. attorney delivered a letter to Jewell's attorney saying the same. And at that point, Richard Jewell and his poor mother had been through 88 days of hell. They could not check their mail without the media flocking to them. They couldn't go to the grocery store. I mean, it was insane. He was exonerated and afterwards filed a defamation suit against NBC News, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and other media outlets, insisting on a formal apology from them. Many of the suits were settled or tied up in appeals courts, and unfortunately, Richard Jewell passed away on August 29, 2007, from complications related to diabetes. 12 years later, his story would be told on the big screen in the film bearing his name, Richard Jewell, directed and produced by Clint Eastwood.
Clint Eastwood, man. He's a machine.
Really?
It's just so sad. And I mean, I said that about like defamation, because I know defamation and slander suits are so hard to prove because you have to be able to prove, from what I hear, and this could be obviously state to state or whatever, but one of the biggest things is you have to be able to prove that they did it. They had malicious intent, or they tried to take you down, and there's so many little things that you have to prove for you to win.
Yeah. And I don't know that I've ever seen a defamation suit. Can you even file defamation against a law enforcement agency?
See, I don't think you can. I mean, I've never heard it happening.
Because they're not the ones that are necessarily putting it out into the media. They might do a press conference where they talk about something, but the media is the ones that are taking that information and printing it. I wish there was something we could do to law enforcement officers who talk to the media and compromise investigations by doing so.
Absolutely. Like, use it the media. Very frustrating. All of the medias or just like some of the medias?
All the medias. Okay. Every medias.
Okay. Wow. You're really taking on the big dogs here.
Yep.
After Jewell was cleared, the FBI admitted that they had no clue who did it. Must have been a tail tucked between your legs kind of day. So then in 1997, two more bombings took place. One at an abortion clinic and one at a lesbian nightclub, and both were in the Atlanta area. There were similarities in how the bombs were constructed and materials that were used, which led investigators to believe that the person who was also responsible for the Olympic bombing was also responsible for these bombings. So, another bomb went off at an abortion clinic in Birmingham, Alabama. This time, a police officer working as a security guard was killed and a nurse was injured. But upon investigating the Atlanta bomb, the FBI was able to get clues from witnesses, including a partial license plate of the person they thought planted the bomb.
Done fucked up.
Yep, fucked around, found out. The plate led them to Eric Robert Rudolph. Rudolph was a handyman and carpenter. When he learned he was a suspect, he R-U-N-N-O-F-T. He disappeared into the wilderness of the Southern Appalachian Mountains, which he was familiar with when he visited as a young man. And he was put on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, and $1 million reward was offered for his capture. In October of 1998, he was officially named as the suspect in all four bombings. I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time In this house, when we say the word bomb, which is more than you would think, we quote Pink Panther, a bim.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for me not to say the bimmings.
Mm.
In May of 2003, a rookie police officer was patrolling around a Save-A-Lot grocery store in Murphy, North Carolina at 4 a.m. He spotted a man near the dumpster around the back of the store and initially suspected a burglary. He approached the man, who was unarmed and did not resist. The man was clean-shaven except for a mustache with dyed black hair, and this man was Eric Rudolph. In October of 2003, he was formally charged with the bimmings. In April of 2005, the Department of Justice announced that Rudolph had accepted a plea bargain to avoid the death penalty. As part of the deal, he led the FBI to 250 pounds of dynamite he had hidden in the woods of North Carolina. How do you get that many pounds of it up there?
That's like so much dynamite.
How many trips do you have to? And this, again, this is the second reference I've made to it. This isn't a fucking Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner episode.
I know, where it's like dynamite? You just take your crane and dump your dynamite in there and... Yeah.
Yes.
Like, what is going on? A lot of the materials that he used were things that you could get in, like, you know, hunting stores and stuff like that. But like, can you just go to the store and be like, 200 sticks of dynamite, please?
Right? Like, I feel like, again, because we talked about it earlier today too, but like trimmers, like that guy, I can't think of his name for anything. The one that was married to Reba and he had the call of explosives.
Was his name Ray?
Bert! His name was Bert.
It was Bert. Okay. I thought Ray.
He looks like a Ray, though. I can't blame you there. He also kind of looks like Aaron Tippin to me in a weird way. But, yeah, are you that guy? You just, like, drive around in a Hummer with 3,000 pounds of... Like, I don't get it.
No. No.
Anyway. Rudolph released a statement explaining his actions. He rationalized the bombings as serving the cause of anti-abortion and anti-gay terrorism. In his statement, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, what gay terrorism has befallen us?
I don't know. And it's
confused.
It's such a problem that you have to fight that gay terrorism with anti-gay terrorism. Have to do it with bombs. My also second favorite thing about this entire situation is that he accepted a plea deal so his little ass could stay alive. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, he doesn't give a care in the world about anybody else's lives that are at stake here.
Well, and he also hates the government with all of his being, but then he entered into a plea deal with them, but not because now he likes the government, because now they can save him.
Right.
It's, you know, it's all part of his plan. It's all part of his plan. It really makes sense if you think about it.
And I'm thinking about, so he bombed an abortion clinic. Isn't that kind of counterintuitive if you're trying to...
Yes, because I saw news articles where people were just talking to, you know, let's find out what this guy on the street says or this lady on the street says. And so there were people that were saying, well, yeah, I support him because he bombed a baby murdering clinic. And I'm like, so what if there was a woman in there who was just getting a consultation and decided not to do it? It doesn't make any sense. Like, and to support, okay, whatever. In his statement, he claimed that he had, quote, deprived the government of its goal of sentencing me to death. And the fact that I've entered an agreement with the government is a purely tactical choice on my part and in no way legitimates the moral authority of the government to judge this matter or impute my guilt, of course. In total, Eric Rudolph was sentenced to 4 consecutive life sentences. He was sent to the ADX Florence Supermax prison in Colorado. He spends 23 hours per day alone in his 80-square-foot cell. The TV series Manhunt told the story of Richard Jewell, the Atlanta bombing, and Eric Rudolph in season 2 of the show. And that is it.
Outrageous.
Yeah. Yep. So that is the case, guys. Definitely let us know what you think in the comments or in our Facebook group. We've got a free one and one for our patrons, so check it out there. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye. All right, you guys. It's shout out time. Yippee. We love to hear it.
Sure do.
Yeah, so this is the time when we thank our newest patrons. By the way, if you signed up in Apple, they don't give us your name.
Right. But if you want to have a shout out, just shoot us a quick little email.
Mm-hmm. Or cancel Apple and go to Patreon, which we would love for you to do anyway. But, you know, just saying. So if you're like, what the fuck? I'm a patron on Apple. They don't let us know that. So
yes.
I'm so sorry. But these are $10 patrons or higher. We want to give a hey girl thanks to Lynn Kabbalah,
Lucy C,
Michaela Carroll,
Erica Black,
Samantha Kruger,
Ronnie Lackey,
Vicky Eaton,
Tracy Weber or Weber,
Cecilia
Key,
Sid Trumbo,
Lisa Jimenez,
Ruby Duffy,
Carlin Dietz,
Jess,
Molly Tuvey,
Alexis Newkirk,
Amber Krager,
Ashley Saha,
Desiree Fredericks,
Justine Franco,
Ada Donnelly,
Lacey Temple,
Jenny Crawford,
Reagan Finn,
Jackie Spivey,
Molly,
Ariana Lang,
Heather Hot Dog,
ah! Jasmine Suarez,
Cam Jones,
Childish Nambino.
Come on. Okay, that's cool. I like that. Sharon Sharp,
Chance Parker,
Dahlia. Or Talia? I don't. Talia? Sorry.
Samantha Lackey.
Jessica.
Lexi Engel.
Amanda Cleary. Thank you guys so much. We love you.
Yes. We cannot do this without you.
Yes. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation.
Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye.
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud.
Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.